the studios of Central Coast Public Radio in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. On my bookshelf this week is a biography of the first First Lady to be called First Lady, Mary Lincoln. The author is Catherine Clinton, and she joins us tonight from Belfast. Catherine Clinton, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. A shout from Belfast.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing because when President Lincoln was killed, I think it took a week or something for the news to reach California, and here we are talking from California to Belfast. Pretty amazing.
It is. It is. It's a global world and a global Lincoln that we're dealing with in the 21st century.
Well, you and I have been trying to have this conversation, find the time for this conversation for a while now, so it's really nice to have the opportunity finally.
It's been a busy bicentennial year, and as I am in Belfast, I teach at Queen's University. It's also the bicentennial of Charles Darwin, so I've actually been juggling several balls in the air, the 200th anniversary of two of these great influential people who shaped history in a way and shaped the world we live in today. But I didn't want the wife of our 16th president to get lost in the shuffle.
Well, your book, and it's a fine book, and everybody should read it. It begins with the great tragedy of Mary Lincoln's life, and you know the great tragedy for our nation, the death of the 16th president of the United States, Abraham Lincoln. But the tragedy of that long night for Mrs. Lincoln was made even more tragic. Can you talk about that a little?
Sure. Well, I wanted to open with that because I, of course, hope that my book will be for people who are very interested in Abraham Lincoln, but I've also found some people reading it who don't know much about the 19th century, the Civil War, or the life of the Lincoln. So I tried to begin by letting people know that in the 19th century, the American woman was a symbol of the home, was a symbol of the family, and her duty was, of course, to take care of her loved ones. The mortality rates in the 19th century were so horrific, children dying, parents dying, spouses dying, that a 19th century woman knew that one of her most sacred duties was to tend to the bedside of a dying relative, and no duty was more sacred than to take care of your dying spouse. So it was with great, great horror that I discovered the night that Lincoln died. It was a circle of men who surrounded Lincoln at his bedside, and there was even a moment where Mrs. Lincoln's hysterical sobbing led Edwin Stanton, the Secretary of War, to say, take that woman out of her and don't let her back in. And so she was removed from the room where her husband was dying, and indeed when the men gathered for a prayer at 7 a.m. and Lincoln died at 7:22 a.m. that Easter Saturday, Mrs. Lincoln was down the hall in another parlor, and she collapsed again into hysterics when she discovered her husband was gone and she hadn't even been there. And I think it was a doubly tragic moment because, of course, the loss was so horrible to the nation, victorious less than a week since victory for the Union, and Lincoln had achieved what seemed impossible. The long nightmare was ended. And yet, for Mrs. Lincoln, the nightmare began that night when she was shoved out, left on her own, and indeed she felt bereft and unbalanced, I think, ever after.
It's just a horrible thing, and you're, you know, it's a way of looking at the story that we've never looked at it before. It's just so tragic that she was even led to believe that he might recover, so she really was shocked.
Yes, she was. It was certainly she had lost their second son, Eddie, in 1850, and then many people know that the Lincolns lost their beloved son, Willie, in 1862 when he was just 11. And that morning and her wearing her mourning weeds in the White House for a year, she mourned the loss of her son. And so we do think of Mrs. Lincoln as a figure in grief. And then to see that that she could never imagine, of course, the loss of her husband. And it was something, though, that was always with her, because on their trip to Washington from Springfield. There were threats on Lincoln's life, and he had to literally be brought into Washington in the night in disguise because of these death threats that began as soon as he was elected, not even before he took office.
Now, you were saying that Mary Todd Lincoln never really recovered from the death of her husband, and there was just more tragedy to come in her life.
Yes, indeed. And I do, in my book, I hope, try and talk about some of the mythology that surrounds her. She certainly was extremely proud of her Todd heritage, but the use of the name Mary Todd Lincoln is something that I talk about in my book because it is used by historians, it's used by scholars, but it's actually something that came about in the 20th century. She never called herself Mary Todd Lincoln. So imagine my surprise when I went back into the archives looking at all the material and saw that she would only sign her name as Mary Lincoln or Mrs. Lincoln. The Todd was something that got added when we started looking back at first ladies in the 20th century, and we saw another famous first lady. We saw Dolly Todd Madison. So it was the Todd family in the 20th century that emphasized this connection. She was happy to be Mrs. Lincoln, and as you say, following her husband's death, she was trying to take on the role of first widow and burnish the legacy of her husband. Today, it's probably unimaginable to us that Lincoln, during his presidency, was so ridiculed and scorned, and that because of his support of the Emancipation Proclamation, because of his stand against slavery, he was often referred to in the press as an ape and other kinds of epithets. So his triumph of the victory of restoring the Union was something that Mrs. Lincoln wanted to dedicate her life to. But first she had her young son Tad and her older son Robert to look after. But it was Robert who grew to look after his mother because she was so diminished by her husband's death. She eventually took Tad over to Europe for his education in Germany and in England. But when they came back to America in 1871, back to Chicago, Tad died shortly after his 18th birthday. And this was yet another blow, yet another loss for Mrs. Lincoln. She was in Chicago contemplating where she might go next when the Great Chicago Fire broke out. The city was reduced to rubble, and the death and the mourning overwhelmed her, and she began to wander. And it wasn't until 1875, the 10th anniversary of her husband's assassination, that her son Robert felt she was so unbalanced that she might do harm to herself, and a group of men in Chicago judged her legally incompetent and put her into the custodial care of her son Robert, and she was confined to an asylum.
Did she object to this confinement?
Yes, she absolutely was. She was first in shock because when authorities came to take her to the courthouse to have a hearing on her mental state, and indeed her name was put on what were called the lunatic rolls of Chicago when she was finally condemned to mental incompetence by a trial of 12 men, she asked for Robert, and they told her that Robert was there, that it was actually Robert who was instigating this action against her. She was confined to the Bellevue Sanitarium in Batavia, Illinois, and it took quite a campaign. She wrote to Myra Bradwell, who was a leading woman lawyer of the era, married to a judge, and the Bradwells campaigned in the press in order to obtain release for Mrs. Lincoln. She was able to go to her sister's home in Springfield, her older sister, Elizabeth Edwards, and to remain there for several months until she was finally, after a year, given back her legal rights. Robert had control of all of her money. Robert could have her returned to the asylum should her behavior be deemed inappropriate. So she really felt as if she was humiliated, scarred, certainly alienated from her only remaining child, Robert Todd Lincoln.
Well, history, as you point out, has just not exactly been kind to her. In fact, I even found the cover of your book to be a revelation. I mean, she's very beautiful in this picture that's on the cover.
Well, she was, as a young girl, considered quite a belle when she moved from her hometown in Lexington, Kentucky, out onto the plains to Springfield, where many Kentuckians went during the early decades of the 19th century. She was considered a great belle. Indeed, Lincoln courted her along with a whole group of politicians. It was said that Stephen Douglas was even a little bit in love with her, and later during the great debates between Lincoln and Douglas, it was Mrs. Lincoln who said that although Stephen Douglas was known as the little giant, her husband was a giant in more ways than his height. So she was a great supporter and defender of her husband, and indeed considered quite a catch in her day. She was well connected. Her relatives had been ambassadors, senators, governors. Two of her sisters were married to the sons of governors, and here she picked a humble lawyer from the backwoods. Indeed, her family objected originally to the connection with Lincoln. They said that he was no better than the dirt floors he'd been brought up on, and there was a great deal of scorn for Abraham Lincoln, who was indeed poor, unconnected, and had nothing but his talent and Mrs. Lincoln's belief in him.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Catherine Clinton, and her book is called Mrs. Lincoln, A Life. Legend tells us that Mary Lincoln was not the great love of Lincoln's life, that was Anne Rutledge or some.
Sure. There was, we were talking about the problem she had losing her husband. And when her husband died, as I said, she wanted to burnish his legacy and make him the shining martyr that she knew he was, that he had died for his country. He had sacrificed everything. She cooperated by giving an interview to William Herndon, who was Lincoln's former law partner in Springfield, who was interviewing people and doing a biography of Lincoln. She wanted as much positive press, and she knew that Billy Herndon worshipped Lincoln, so she cooperated by giving him an interview. Imagine her shock and horror when, a few years after Lincoln's death, Herndon went on the circuit lecturing, and one of the lectures he offered was telling about Lincoln's first, and what he said was his true and only love, Anne Rutledge. This came as quite a shock to both Mrs. Lincoln and her sons, and Robert went on the warpath. But as we know, in the 20th century, this legend became exalted, and it was a great pain and sorrow to Mrs. Lincoln to have someone accuse her of not being the love of Lincoln's life. She was his wife for more than 20 years. She gave birth to four of his children. They raised a family together. And indeed, in my book, I try to emphasize that it was Mary Lincoln's steadfast support and connections during the early years of their marriage that led to Abraham Lincoln's political success.
Well, what kind of a relationship did they have? You know, I don't know how you can research it and find out, but I mean, you know.
We do have letters between mm-hmm. the two of them, and we do have only a few, because actually there were some legends that we have verified in truth, in that we know that when the Lincolns went off to Washington, they decided to store many of their goods, but they also had a burn pile in the backyard, and Mary Lincoln was a very private person. She didn't want her personal stuff to be perused, and so many private letters were consigned, we think, to the burn pile. But we also know she talked about having a cache of letters in a box, and they never turned up, they never were found. We also know that Robert Lincoln, later in his life, while his mother was alive, collected her letters, and it is believed that he consigned many of her writings to the flames as well. In the letters that we do have between the Lincolns, we find warm, funny correspondence. We also have Lincoln very tenderly asking after her. We also have, like many husbands, him questioning her bills that she left and charges. And this, of course, is something that is also quite infamous, Mrs. Lincoln's relationship with money, which I do suggest in my book was perhaps that she suffered from a disorder that might be akin to financial bulimia. She was someone who...
She was a compulsive shopper.
She was a compulsive shopper. But I try and contextualize it and say that when the Lincolns were first married, he came to the marriage with a debt. She moved from a large home on Aristocracy Hill with her sister's family into the Globe Tavern. She was very, very economic. They were able to move into their own home through her father's generosity. She was someone who supported Lincoln when he went out on the circuit to earn money as a lawyer. She was someone who made all of her own clothes, all the children's clothes. Mr. Lincoln was the only person who had his clothes made by a tailor, and this was true throughout the early years of their marriage. When he became a more prosperous lawyer and he was expanding his political horizons, Mrs. Lincoln was a very generous hostess. She used to hold parties in their home for up to 300 people were issued invitations to move to flow through their very small home in Springfield. But she was someone who had great plans, great ambitions. And indeed, when she did finally arrive in Washington to move into the executive mansion, her husband had what was considered a lavish salary at that time, $20,000. And it was something where she did, for the first time, begin to contemplate having her own luxuries. Lincoln, by the way, on the way to Washington, stopped off in New York. We don't know when he did it, but we do know that he did do it because we have the bill, and he went to Tiffany's and obtained a set of seed pearls for her, a necklace, earrings, bracelets, a ring, because he presented this gift to Mrs. Lincoln as a tribute for her contributions to his road to the White House.
Well, how did Mary and Abraham Lincoln meet?
Well, we don't have an exact moment when we know they met. It was in Springfield. We know it was when both of them were there in 1839. We have some idea that Lincoln might have come courting to the parlor of Ninian Edwards, who was the son of the governor, who later became a political colleague of his in the state legislature. We know that Lincoln knew about the Todd family, because the Todds were so well connected in Springfield. It is said that when they first met, Lincoln asked Mary to dance, and she later said that he said he wanted to dance with me in the worst way, and he did. So we do know that it was a rather awkward first meeting. We do know that the two of them were intellectually quite well matched. She read poetry and Shakespeare. She had had 10 years education to his 1 year of education, but she was one of the best educated women in her circle. Indeed, when we look at the United States and we look at women's education at this time, she was one of the best educated women
of her time
in the country at that time. And so he was attracted to someone who was so well read, who knew Henry Clay as a young girl. Henry Clay was Abraham Lincoln's ideal. And imagine hearing about Henry Clay from someone who used to ride her pony out to his home, Ashland in Lexington, and spend time at his dinner table and knew him quite well. Indeed, after Lincoln was elected to Congress and they went on a trip to Washington, they stopped off in Lexington, where he got to meet his idol and be involved with the political connections of the Todds in Kentucky. It was, however, very disappointing, because although Mr. Lincoln had political ambitions, Mrs. Lincoln also had social ambitions, and when they did go for his one term as a congressman, she was confined to the boarding house with two young children while he was off in Congress and politicking, and he's spending a lot of time, as much time as possible, in the Library of Congress, because Lincoln was a voracious reader, a voracious learner, a lifelong learner, and that's, again, something that sparked their interests and kept them, I think, engaged throughout the long years of their marriage.
We're talking with Catherine Clinton, and her book is called Mrs. Lincoln, A Life, and it's a wonderful book. Doris Kearns Goodwin praises the book. with good reason. But let me
Doris
ask you.
Doris was very generous in that when she first began her Lincoln project, she was actually scheduled to do a book on Abraham and Mary. But about halfway through it, Mary dropped away because she was much more interested in the male circle around Lincoln. And Team of Rivals became the theme and indeed the core of her book. These other men who rivaled him as politicians, these other men who became so very close to him. And that is something that she's been a great friend and supporter. And, of course, her views and her insights are so enlightening for me that I was able to, in some ways, begin my book in a similar way, talking about the men who did surround him, who he came to love. Seward and Stanton were men who really began with deep scorn for Lincoln, but by the end of his presidential career, he was their idol.
Well, there's something bizarre in your book that I want to ask you about. You know, so much is made of the sort of silly coincidences between Kennedy and Lincoln's assassinations, but this thing about President Garfield is pretty weird, that Lincoln's son was with President Garfield at the moment that he was assassinated. It's kind of odd.
It was true that Robert returned home from war on April 14, 1865, and in my book, this is something that I emphasize that I won't say I discovered it, but it's something I think that other scholars have overlooked, which is that Robert went off to war, and this deeply, deeply wounded Mary Lincoln, who had begged her husband to keep Robert out of uniform and out of harm's way. But finally, in January of 1865, he went off to war. He returned home on April 14th. He was in the White House the very night that Lincoln was shot at Ford's Theater. He went to the Peterson boarding house. He was there with his father when he died. He later became a lawyer in Chicago and was primed for political positioning. He was adopted, really, by a circle of Lincoln's cronies, including David Davis of the Supreme Court. And he was someone who people saw great things in his future. He was the son of Lincoln. The Republican Party had anointed him. So there he was, Garfield's companion on a trip, walking across Union Station when Garfield is shot. Garfield, as you know, lingered for many months before he died. But imagine what a terrible trauma it was for Mary Lincoln to have her son in the company of the president who's assassinated. And also, of course, Garfield's assassination in 1881 revived the interest and focus on presidential assassination and dragged her memories back into the open. It was within a year, Mary herself died, and she was someone who very much mourned anniversaries, mourned remembrances of this kind. And I also comment that it was Robert's great misfortune to arrive in Buffalo the very day that McKinley was shot. So in some ways, Robert Lincoln was present, was in the same place when three presidents were assassinated.
That's pretty odd.
Well, Sarah Vowell's book, Assassination Vacation, which I think is a wonderful historical tour de force about it, a person's obsession and then seeking out information. And she's someone who does, I think, follow this through in a really interesting, sardonic way,
that's
which is her historical take on things.
Yeah, that's a wonderful book. You speculate as to what Mary Lincoln didn't really live a very long life. She was only 63 when she died.
Yes, and she did feel that she had taken her son Tad abroad, and while abroad, she felt, I think, well served by being the widow of the martyr president, as she always referred to him. So while in Europe, she felt she was accorded the respect and the regard that was not forthcoming in the United States. And certainly after her incarceration and her public scandal of her son confining her to an asylum in 1875, the minute that she was released, she began to plot her escape. And she did go to Europe in 1877 in order to get away from what she thought was this terrible trauma of being viewed as Crazy Mary. When she was in Europe, she also took treatment. She had a problem with her back. We now know that she may have suffered from diabetes. There are people who speculate, I think quite wildly, on her medical condition. I continue to say, despite debates, and I recently participated in a debate this summer that I call the Second Battle of Gettysburg, where many people wanted to diagnose Mary Lincoln, and I try to say that my degrees are in history, not in medicine, and I can only say that I do know that she suffered from a variety of ills, and many of them indeed perhaps stem from physical problems, but clearly grief and sorrow would often overwhelm her, and she felt in Europe not only could she be alone when she chose to, but then when she did emerge, she was given respect because Lincoln's reputation in Europe was quite strong at that time.
Well, we're just about out of time, and I want to let everybody know the book is called Mrs. Lincoln, A Life, and the author is Catherine Clinton, and she is a history professor at Queen's University in Belfast. You must have a lot of students now.
We bring over students from the U.S. for our one-year master's in U.S. history, and also we this year had a program of sending some of our Queen's students both to Springfield, to the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library, and to Gettysburg as Lincoln interns. So we think it's a great program of exchange, and we tell people, come on over to Northern Ireland. Belfast is a great place to visit and a great European capital.
How do you compare Irish college students with American college students?
Oh, I taught at Harvard, I taught at the Citadel, I taught at the University of Richmond, and I always say you get wonderful students wherever you go. It's lovely having Irish students who are so interested intensely in American life, and now we're having a great surge of interest. We call it over here in the UK, because I am in the UK, we call it the Obama bounce. People are mightily interested in the United States, and of course, what a wonderful time it is because President Obama pays great tribute to Abraham Lincoln and his role in political legacy. So I think it's a wonderful time to be exchanging ideas about America's greatness.
What are you working on now? Will you be writing another book soon?
Soon will be the sesquicentennial of the American Civil War, and I'm working on a book about the Emancipation Proclamation. The book I did before Mrs. Lincoln was Harriet Tubman, and I was quite interested in the role that ex-slaves themselves played in bringing about emancipation. And so I think the Emancipation Proclamation and its 150th anniversary is certainly something to celebrate.
Well, I hope you'll come and talk to us about that when that happens.
It'll be great, Gary. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you for being with us. The book is Mrs. Lincoln, A Life, Catherine Clinton. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for this week's episode of From the Bookshelf, but I'll be back again next week with another great program. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. And I want to thank Catherine Clinton, author of Mrs. Lincoln, for spending some time with us this week. Check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on iTunes and Facebook. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening, everybody.